China put on an elaborate show of strength with a parade and summit this week, but it was a guest who was the biggest winner.
Kim Jong-un had an absolutely terrific week.
I'm Carolyn Buehler. On today's show, North Korea in the spotlight. And in Jamaica, voters gave their prime minister a third term. Some voters, anyway.
There was a really genuine expectation that more would turn up at the polls, but that didn't happen.
A new delivery startup in Brazil gets packages to people who don't have addresses, and what internet restrictions mean for people in Iran.
Imagine one day you wake up and you don't have access to any information. You don't have access to Google Maps. You don't have access to your Gmail.
Plus the merits of vultures. Those stories and more all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Buehler. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. China's leader Xi Jinping grabbed the international spotlight this week. Xi put on a giant military parade showing off Chinese weaponry. He also brought together more than two dozen world leaders for a major summit. China was able to present itself there as a force for global stability and economic growth. There was that one embarrassing moment caught on mic. That's Xi Jinping chatting with Vladimir Putin about extending human life with organ transplants. But all in all, things went well for China's leader. It was also a turning point for Kim Jong-un. The North Korean dictator has been an international pariah for years, but that is starting to change. The World's Matthew Bell has our story.
Last night, Kim Jong-un stood in the doorway of his armored train, waving and smiling as it departed Beijing. On the platform, teenagers in patriotic uniforms are waving Chinese and North Korean flags. Kim has traveled to Beijing several times, but never for a major multilateral summit like this. And things went very well for the North Korean leader.
I think Kim Jong-un had an absolutely terrific week.
Katie Stollard is the author of Dancing on Bones, History and Power in China, Russia, and North Korea.
He is really able to show for his domestic propaganda, that he is now a serious statesman, that he is front and center at these big events, and North Korea's interests have to be taken seriously.
Stollard says it's worth stepping back and remembering just how isolated Kim was not so long ago. In 2017, both China and Russia signed on to international sanctions for North Korea. This was part of a global consensus with the U.S. and its allies in Asia about forcing Kim to give up his nuclear ambitions. But Stollard says that consensus has largely evaporated.
There is no prospect whatsoever now that China and Russia will again join those sort of sanctions on him. So his nuclear and his wider weapons programs are rapidly advancing. And he suddenly found himself a player.
That's Vladimir Putin speaking during a meeting in Beijing this week with Kim Jong-un. The Russian leader said North Korean soldiers have fought bravely and heroically in Ukraine. We will never forget, Putin said, the losses that your armed forces and families of your soldiers suffered. Russia and North Korea have a new defense and security pact. Katie Stollard says it's not exactly clear what Moscow is giving to Kim Jong-un in return for the troops and ammunition he's sending to Ukraine.
But at a minimum, he's getting a lot of hard capital, and he may well also be getting technical support for technologies that he still wants.
Such as advanced missile systems, submarine technology, and possibly nuclear know-how. Another win for Kim this week came when he met with Xi Jinping. During their previous meetings, the Chinese leader talked about the need for North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. That didn't happen this time. China's CCTV reported that Kim and Xi met and talked about forging closer ties. Christopher Green is an Asia expert with the International Crisis Group. He says Kim made real progress in Beijing, presenting himself as a serious world leader. But old tensions with China are still there, even if they're under the surface.
North Korea, they deeply dislike the Chinese, who they see as supercilious, overbearing and generally trying to control them, which is not entirely untrue. So the two sides have quite negative views of each other, but they can both see that they need each other. The North Koreans really need the Chinese. Without the Chinese, the North Koreans would be in a whole load of trouble.
And that's because China is North Korea's biggest trading partner. Green says Kim also made progress rehabilitating his global reputation during the first Trump administration. Trump and Kim met a total of 3 times, and the president recently said he'd like to meet with Kim again. But Green says that's not likely to happen because the North Korean leader walked away from those talks with very little, other than the propaganda value of meeting directly with the president of the United States. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
The Trump administration has been slashing funds for foreign assistance, including programs designed to combat internet restrictions imposed by autocratic regimes. In Iran, the effects have been dire. Activists there say the cuts and delays in funding are already having an impact on their work. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
There's always one thing that Evan Alireza Firouzi has in mind when it comes to technological solutions.
I don't like technologies that my grandpa cannot use.
Tech tools, he says, should be easy to use and accessible to everyone. So when he and his team designed a tool that allows Iranians to get online, they had this in mind. Almost everyone in Iran has a satellite dish, which they use to watch foreign television programs. Firouzi and his team took advantage of the satellite signals to transfer files from outside the country.
I actually tested with my grandpa, and the usage of this system was very easy, so there is no learning curve.
This was around 2014. Since then, Firouzi says the technology, which is called Touche, has helped millions of Iranians access the internet without restrictions. They've shared a whole variety of files.
Updates for operating systems, security updates for different applications, privacy tools, educational content.
Iran is the 3rd most repressive country for internet freedom after China and Myanmar. That's according to Freedom House, a U.S.-based organization that tracks democracy, human rights, and internet freedom globally. The Iranian government frequently shuts down services, particularly during mass protests or heightened security situations. At times, that can even endanger lives, says Firouzi, like earlier this summer when the Israeli forces carried out airstrikes on the country.
The IDF, Israeli army, was issuing notices on what is the safest place to be, where it's not safe to stay. And without internet, nobody could hear about this information.
He says later he heard from people inside Iran about how Touche helped them access news and other helpful information. This work is done through a Los Angeles-based NGO called Net Freedom Pioneers. It's one of several organizations that have been receiving funding from the U.S. government. The recent cuts are threatening their programs.
Everything is in a limbo. There is no direct indication that fundings are being reinstated or not.
The State Department, which is in charge of handing out the funds, didn't respond to my interview request. Historically, internet freedom projects in Iran have been supported by both sides of the aisle in Washington. They even continued during the first Trump administration.
We've seen several tools, technologies that were used to circumvent the Islamic Republic's censorship and surveillance. These tools have gone offline because the money is no longer there to keep them alive.
Mani Mostofi heads the MEON group, which works on human rights and internet freedom in the Middle East. Some of the programs offer digital safety and protection for activists, he says. VPNs or retro private networks that helped activists connect to the internet.
As these things go offline, you see women's rights activities go offline. You see human rights lawyers having a hard time doing their jobs.
The organizations have been trying to secure funding from elsewhere, like from private donations, but activists say they are no match to government funding. According to the House Appropriations Committee report, about $17 million was set aside for internet freedom efforts in Iran this year. Mostofi says organizations are facing other complications when trying to get money from private foundations.
Because they run into sanctions compliance, whereas if the U.S. government is funding itself, it could just give itself permission to fund these things.
As these tools go offline, activists say more and more people will lose unrestricted access to the internet. They'll also be left without support during total internet blackouts. Evan Alireza Firouzi again.
When we live in the free world, it's really hard to imagine how a world without internet works. Imagine one day you wake up and you don't have access to any information. You don't have access to Google Maps. You don't have access to your Gmail. You don't have access to your WhatsApp.
In today's world, connectivity to the internet is not a privilege, he says, but a necessity. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The world's top tennis players are in New York City for the U.S. Open, which started last week. And the big finale is finally here. The competition has been packed with action, with the decisive moments still to come. The world's Bianca Hillier gets us up to speed heading into the finals.
Sometimes in sports, the biggest stars of the game are the ones who seem to always come out on top. But I'd argue that nothing grabs a crowd's attention quite like a redemption story.
And she's got it. Anna Samova handles the moment.
In a tough match last night, American Amanda Anisimova beat Naomi Osaka to earn her spot in the finals. That would be enough for any player to celebrate, but it means more after what Anisimova has been through this summer. Let's go back to Wimbledon in July. At the start, things went way better than expected.
Amanda Anisimova doing things she would have dreamt of last night.
Anisimova surprised the tennis world by making it to the very end. But in the final match, she failed to win a single game.
It's like she's frozen. She's paralyzed out there and just cannot find her game.
See that final.
Six love. It was the most lopsided loss at Wimbledon in over 100 years. And the headlines alone, calling the match humiliating, could have been enough to derail the rest of her season. But Anisimova, who was born in the U.S. to Russian parents, said no way. The U.S. Open has been her revenge tour, and tomorrow's final is the last stop. At a press conference last night, she chalked it up to a shift in mindset.
I feel like when I was at Wimbledon, every single match was kind of like a surprise to me, and I was like shocked with every match that I won. But here it feels like more, I believe in myself and I'm able to do it.
To get the trophy, she'll have to beat Aryna Sabalenka. She's the defending champion and world number one, but has struggled a bit during this year's biggest moments. She lost in the Australian Open final, same thing at the French Open. At a press conference last night, the Belarusian player said she's trying to approach this final with a clean slate.
I'm super excited to give myself another opportunity, another final. If I'll be able to hold that trophy, it's going to mean a lot for me, and I'll be just the happiest person on earth, probably.
She is the favorite going into the match and has had a relatively breezy tournament so far. Sabalenka even got to skip one round when her opponent withdrew due to injury before the match began. The only hiccup, if you will, was a happy one.
We do a marriage proposal on the big screen. Now this is pressure, never mind the tennis.
During a break in one of Sabalenka's earlier matches, a diamond ring came out in the stands and a couple got engaged. The crowd went wild, but Sabalenka, known for her focus on the court, kept a poker face. After the match, she said she had to make an effort to not start smiling.
You know, because it's very cute and I believe they're super happy right now, you know, and I was just trying to keep like focusing on my game. But I looked at my boyfriend. Yeah. No pressure.
The real pressure will come tomorrow on the court as Sabalenka plays for her fourth Grand Slam win and Anisimova goes for her first. The men's semifinals are this afternoon and evening, with those winners battling for the trophy on Sunday. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It's been election week in Jamaica, where Prime Minister Andrew Holness just won a third term in office. Holness has lowered the country's homicide rate dramatically, and he's gotten international accolades for how he has handled the economy. His policies, though, have drawn criticism in Jamaica and beyond. So, how'd he win? Rosalie Hamilton is the founding director of Jamaica's Institute of Law and Economics based in Kingston. She told me that voter turnout was underwhelming.
I think the major thing is the disappointment that many of us have that about 60% of the electorate did not turn up and vote. So we have no idea what their views are. And so, we have to really do a careful study and analysis as to who they are and what happened there.
Is that what 38% turnout unusual for Jamaica?
It's been trending down for some time, and that's not unusual for Jamaica and many countries across the world. We've been seeing that trend. With respect to the specific issues in Jamaica, however, there's been a lot of work over the last few years to build awareness about civic responsibility in a democracy. And so there was a real genuine expectation that more would turn up at the polls, but that didn't happen. And so when we see levels of voter turnout that's comparable to the last election, which was during COVID, many of us are very surprised and disappointed. So that for me is the major issue coming out of the election. I think there's also the view that there was some disappointment that the issues that have been plaguing the prime minister and members of his administration didn't seem to feature. And what featured was the so-called achievements. And I say so-called because there's an interpretation of the numbers as signaling social and economic well-being for the majority of Jamaicans. And that's not the expressed lived experience of many Jamaicans. A quick example is the low unemployment rate. Unprecedented low, but it masks the reality that there is high underemployment and that wages are typically very, very low. And so these are some of the issues that Jamaicans face.
So you're saying, a third term for Holness is being seen as or being read as kind of a vote of confidence in what is happening in Jamaica, specifically socioeconomic conditions. But you're saying that should not be how it is read.
For some people and those who absolutely went out and vote, that exactly is what they've done. They've said, yes, we agree with the progress. We want to see more. But for many Jamaicans who either didn't vote or voted against the government, they're seeing this as more difficulties. The interpretation of the 60% is that it will make no difference because displayed and expressed dissatisfaction with both political parties.
So let's start maybe with those who did vote for Holness and wanted to see some of the things he campaigned on continue. So, for example, he campaigned on the economy and a reduction in crime. What is he known for by his supporters in those areas?
Well, what the supporters are responding to is over the last year or so, we've seen for the first time significant declines in the numbers of murders. And of course, Jamaica for too long has been one of the murder capitals of the world. And so that is significant. The concerns there, however, is that it has been associated with higher than normal levels of police killings. And so human rights activists have been concerned about the absence of, for example, the body cameras. And so there's been concern about that. But nonetheless, in spite of that, there are many, many Jamaicans that are happy to see the numbers go down.
And what about on the economy? What are the pros and cons there for Holness?
I think there, the strength of the economy for some people, there is a minority that are doing very well in Jamaica, and it's evident in the cars that they drive, the houses they live in, etc. So that portion of the Jamaican population that is benefiting from the economy would no doubt support what is happening. And those who may not be doing as well, but they're coping and they buy into the idea that we're on the right track and that they expect things to be better. And some of the things that they observe is there's massive infrastructure works, there's been a lot of buildings, even during COVID. There were questions about the source of funding for some of those buildings. But nonetheless, there's evidence that buildings went up and so on and so on. So people are observing that and therefore feel that, yes, if we continue along this way, then although we're not quite there yet, there's an expectation that things will get better.
On that note, though, the Prime Minister, Andrew Holness, did campaign on doubling the minimum wage in the country, which one would think would start to address some of the income disparities that you've outlined. How plausible is it that he will be able to keep that promise?
Well, I think the question of the minimum wage has to do with the scale of the size of the individuals who earn minimum wage and their productivity. So if we're talking about growing the economy, ultimately we have to be talking about growing productivity. And the extent to which the minimum wage workers are in fact contributing to the growth of productivity is a debate. What everyone, and there was an immediate reaction from the business sector, that many small businesses that dominate the business landscape in Jamaica, 80 to 90% of businesses in Jamaica are either sole proprietors or small businesses, they cannot afford a doubling of the wage, albeit it was announced as a gradual increase. But there's still concern about whether many businesses can absorb that.
Some of the issues that you've outlined here, so basically there being haves and have-nots in the Jamaican economy, and also people have very different views when they go to the polls, those are trends that are universal and very old. Is there something specific about the Jamaican context that you think it's important for us to keep in mind?
Well, I think we have to remember our history. So we've come out of a colonial era that has brought into independence a structure of an economy and a governance structure that was suited for a certain kind of society. 63 years later, Jamaica has changed fundamentally. One feature, for example, that has not changed, I mentioned the educational system. We perpetuate a system in which only a few get the best education. We perpetuate a constitutional arrangement that is highly centralized. And so decisions are made from the top and they trickle down. We perpetuate an economy that benefits only a few. And the vast majority are not equipped to build their capacity to generate competitive businesses and to work at high level skills to earn incomes that can, you know, be close to anything called a living wage. And so those structures have persisted for a long time. And so the structural changes are absolutely necessary for us to be able to transform our economy and our society to meet the challenges of the modern world.
That was Rosalie Hamilton with Election Analysis. She is the founding director of Jamaica's Institute of Law and Economics. Still to come, there's a famous lion statue in Venice. Its origins have never been known until now. You're with The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Germany, a high-profile case has reignited debate over a new gender self-determination law. The law is meant to make it easier for trans and non-binary people to legally change their gender and name. The law is back in the news since a convicted neo-Nazi and far-right extremist came out as transgender, then asked to be sent to a women's prison. The story is getting a lot of attention. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry explains.
Before Marla Svenja Liebig changed her gender identity, she was a well-known figure in far-right circles. Stefan Marshall, a political scientist at the University of Düsseldorf, uses both he and she pronouns throughout our conversation.
He's an active neo-Nazi in the eastern part of Germany, and he's one who has always fought against gender rights, and that's what he's known for.
In 2022, Liebig disrupted a pride parade in the German city of Halle, calling those taking part parasites on society. The following year, Liebig was sentenced to 18 months in prison for incitement to hatred, slander and insult. Liebig appealed the sentence and late last year came out as a trans woman. At her next court appearance, Marla Svenja Liebig, as she has to be called, arrived in a leopard print top, sporting oversized gold earrings under a wide-brimmed hat, and sat painting her nails. When her appeal was dismissed, she asked to be sent to Chemnitz Women's Prison. Marshall says there's been lots of debate about Liebig's motives, whether she's being genuine or it's all a performance.
Either to avoid getting a sentence in a men's facility or to mock this law and to make transparent in which way it can be misused and abused by whoever would like to do that.
German media has also questioned whether Liebig's change in gender identity is serious. The Gender Identification Act was introduced under Olaf Scholz, the former centre-left chancellor, late last year. It allows transgender, intersex and non-binary people to change their gender marker and their first names in a local registry office. Before that, you needed two psychological assessments and a decision by a court. Carolina Ausserer with the German National Women's Council says those against it, which includes most of the right-wing and far-right parties, presented all sorts of arguments, including that the new law would put women at risk.
For example, it was claimed that trans women in particular pose a threat to safe spaces. It was assumed that they are just as violent as cis men. But there is no evidence to support this claim, because if we look at violence and numbers, we can see that in reality, like, trans women are most vulnerable for violence.
Ausserer says the council, which represents around 60 women's groups across Germany, saw the legislation very differently.
So for us as a National Council of German Women's Organizations, it was clear that we need a new act. We need the Self-Determination Act, that this was long overdue, because it finally recognizes gender diversity as equal and ends the long-standing pathologization of trans, intersex and non-binary people.
Now the case of Marla Svenja Liebig has reignited the whole debate. Last week, the Interior Minister said the law could set a dangerous precedent for extremists intent on mocking the government. The far-right AfD party said those who make absurd laws shouldn't be surprised when they're taken to the extreme. But Ray Hornstein, a legal activist in Berlin, says the fact that Liebig's case is the only one of its kind so far sort of proves the law is working.
This is the only empirical case that we have in this country where it is discussed if that's a case of misuse of the law. So if the government were to take into consideration empirical hard facts in this evaluation of the self-determination law, I'm quite relaxed about that, because there is not much evidence that it needs to be changed into a direction of less self-determination.
Hornstein, who identifies as non-binary and who campaigns for the rights of trans, intersex and non-binary people, says the law isn't perfect. In fact, it needs to go further, Hornstein says. They're not interested in why Liebig has changed her gender identity.
But I was concerned about how it might be misappropriated and weaponized against us.
And that, Hornstein says, is exactly what's happening. The government has announced it plans to re-evaluate the law before August of next year. As for Liebig, no one knows where she is. Last Friday, the day her prison sentence was due to begin, she failed to show. Later, a message appeared on her social media account with an image that read, "Love from Moscow." For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Now we have an update on a story from earlier this week. Aid workers have finally reached the mountain village in Sudan that was devastated by a landslide on Sunday. According to the BBC, the workers used donkeys to reach Tarsin, bringing food and medicine. The landslide was a culmination of days of heavy rains and flash floods in Sudan's Darfur region. Local leaders say hundreds of bodies have been recovered. Some put the number at nearly 400, but it could be even higher. Tarsin is in a remote area controlled by the Sudan Liberation Movement. That's one of several armed groups in Darfur, where Sudan's civil war has been raging for more than 2 years. The full impact of the landslide may not be known for some time. In the heart of Venice, a bronze statue known as the Lion of St. Mark is so iconic that it is a symbol of the city. It's also called the Lion of Venice. It's a winged lion on top of a stone column. It's been there and adored for centuries, but it's never been clear where the statue came from. Researchers from the University of Padua have figured it out. Massimo Vidale co-authored the research.
According to our recent study, both the style of the statue and the chemical signatures of the lead isotopes demonstrate finally that the lion comes from the Blue River, the Yangtze, more precisely from the lower basin of the Yangtze River near Shanghai, so in southeastern China.
So was this a surprise that the statue came all the way from China? It's been there at least since the 1200s, right?
It was a big surprise for everybody. And the evidence is almost paradoxical because the statue is visible, you know, by everybody on a big column just in front of one of the most famous churches in the world. But in reality, it is so high that nobody can really look to the features of the face or the muzzle of this bronze monster. So the symbol of the region is actually a Chinese symbol.
So you say you can't see the statue up close, but I know that you did to do this work. Can you describe what it looks like in a little more detail?
Well, you know, the statue is 16 meters high, so actually from below, you cannot really look at it in close detail. The last time it was brought down, it was in 1990 when it was restored, and we have a lot of pictures of it, of course. And if you look at it frontally, you can really see that the style is not classic, is not Romanesque, it is not Gothic. It is Chinese, actually. But you really need to consider that the original, we believe, Chinese statue was modified. It is a kind of Frankenstein made of different parts, some of which are original and probably date back to the late medieval period, and some others were restored.
Wow. So this lion, as you said, is kind of a Frankenstein. It has these wings. It has kind of like a beard. Which of the details or which parts of it helped tell the story that it is from China?
The frontal part really corresponds stylistically to a Tomb Guardian of the probably Tang period between the 6th and the 9th century AD, so it is about 1,000 years old, something more. And the wings, for example, are later. The wings were remelted and probably recast in Venice in the beginning of the 19th century when that lion got its final form. So in order to be sure to be able to define its origin, we had to use samples coming from the frontal part, meaning the breast of the monster and all that, where all the flocks are made. And those have the typical, unmistakable chemical signatures of the mines of the lower Yangtze River in China.
And so you have this chemical signature, and then the face of the lion is very clearly of the style of this dynasty.
Yeah, we believe like this, you know. Even my daughter, who is not a specialist, she has no interest in archaeology, just looking at the picture of the lion said, "Dad, you know, it's enough to look at it. It is Chinese."
You can tell just by looking at it.
Yes, this is our perception of it. But, you know, it was very difficult to imagine such a colossal statue, because we are speaking of a monster who is 4 meters long.
About 12 feet long.
Yeah, that this was brought from China to Venice. Actually, I believe its parts came from China and they were remounted and reassembled in the form of a winged lion in Venice. So the history is always more complicated than we usually suspect.
So tell me more about that history. Was there a lot of trading between China and Venice way back when? And what time period exactly are we talking about here?
We are talking of the time of the travels of the Polo family, and this makes the story even more intriguing.
Polo, like Marco Polo.
Marco Polo and his father and his uncle, who were the first one to travel from the Black Sea area and then moved first to Bukhara in present-day Uzbekistan. And then they were invited to the court of Kublai Khan.
The Mongol leader was the leader of China at the time.
So these Venetian emissaries, we know that they went to Peking in the mid-13th century.
Mid-13th century.
Yeah, mid-13th century, bringing messages from the Pope to Kublai. It was a very, very strange period in which the Pope from Rome wanted to search the political and military support of the Mongols against the Muslim powers that occupied the Near East. So it is possible that in this early contact between Venice, in the form of the Polo family, the Pope from Rome and the Mongols, somebody went to Peking.
Current day Beijing.
Yeah, in Beijing. And they wanted to probably make a good deal. Probably they found that these pieces of this big monster, which was broken, and they catch the occasion to get it. And then these pieces came to Venice and they were transformed from a Buddhist symbol into the symbol of St. Mark. But of all this possible narrative that I told you now, we do not have any written record. The documents are just silent.
Huh. So this statue is such a recognizable symbol of Venice. How have Italians been responding to your revelation that this statue was not created there?
Well, you know, it was a kind of glamorous discovery. Some people was very, very interested and supported the idea of this already developed chain of trade in the 13th century. Some other people were skeptical, and some other people, again, are very angry because the symbol of the entire region is not something made in Venice, but it came from China. So showing how rooted was the trade identity of Venice already in this early period with the Far East.
Massimo Vidale is with the University of Padua. He just published research establishing at long last that Venice's iconic Lion of St. Mark came from China. You might take it for granted that your street has a name and your home an address, and that when you order something online, it shows up at your door. But for millions of people worldwide, none of this is true. In one of the largest favelas in Sao Paulo, Brazil, residents have long struggled to receive packages. But residents have also come up with a solution. The world's Tibi Saizeya takes us to the streets of Paraíso Polis for the story.
Inside Paraisópolis, the streets climb up a hillside in a tight maze. Houses are packed close together, and the alleys are so narrow that cars can't get in. The motorbikes squeeze past laundry lines and kids playing in the street. For years, the National Postal Service never came here, says Patricia Conceição da Silva, who grew up in this community. We don't have official addresses, she says. To order a pizza, for example, we would explain the house next to Seu Chico's little market, and only people from here understand that. But beyond pizza, most deliveries never arrived. People had to leave the favela to pick up a package, and for the elderly and vulnerable, it was more than an inconvenience. So residents came up with a fix, a delivery company run from inside the favela. It's called Favela Brazil Express, and today it moves a lot more than pizzas.
Dá uma média de uns 1,600 pacotes saindo de Paraisópolis.
Diário. Hilton Mendes helps run operations, and he says they now handle about 1,600 deliveries a day. The company is 100% local and employs residents only because they not only know the alleys, but also the unwritten favela rules and the places not to go that make it safer for them than for outsiders. The packages go first to the Favela Brazil Express warehouse and are distributed from there. I shadowed one of these deliveries on a recent morning. At her fruit shop, resident Lena Mendes had just received a package.
Seu nome?
Lena. Eu compro tanta coisa na internet. Acho que eu sou a louca da internet.
I buy so many things online, she says. Makeup, shampoo, clothes, everything. Now I can order from Amazon, from Shane. Things arrive at my door in a day or two, she says. She pays a small fee for each delivery.
2 days, 1 day.
Now Brazil's National Postal Service, which never had a branch here, opened an office in Paraisópolis. It doesn't deliver door to door, clients still have to pick up packages themselves. But even so, Mendes says it's a sign of official recognition. Now he's involved in an even more ambitious project.
Foi projeto que a gente criou junto ao Google, que é o mapeamento da comunidade. Então,
he says they are collaborating with Google to map out the area. And now nearly every home here has a digital code and can be located on the map. That means anyone can find an address inside the favela. But still, security concerns keep outsiders from entering here. But at least these fixes are bringing something many take for granted: the right to be found at home. For The World, I'm TV Saicea, São Paulo, Brazil.
Don't miss our next conversation about vultures. They look pretty creepy, at least to me, but they also do incredible things. And their declining population in India has been a problem. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. India's Supreme Court has ordered all stray dogs to be rounded up, vaccinated, sterilized, and released. The goal is to help stop the spread of rabies. But it turns out the problem with rabies in India, while connected to dogs, can be traced back to vultures. And the issue with vultures is actually a result of something happening with livestock. Chris Bowden knows all about this. He's with the UK's Royal Society for the Protection of Birds and is based in Bengaluru. Earlier today, he told me that 30 years ago, the vulture population in India was in the millions.
What was the most common species has literally declined by 99.9%.
Wow.
In just 15 years. So they were performing these ecosystem services. I mean, there are 300 million cattle in India. Many of those cattle are not consumed by humans, so they are left rotting, and the vultures were disposing of those carcasses. And having lost so many of the vultures, we are left with a bit of a problem. And dogs have filled that niche to some extent, and we have documented 30% increases in feral dogs. And
so dogs eating some of the carcasses that vultures used to eat and performing some of that cleanup function.
That's right. And it has allowed feral dog numbers to increase. And feral dogs are the main vector for rabies. And there are 9,000 human deaths per year in India alone.
Wow.
Due to rabies. So there are definitely more rabies than there would have been if we'd got the vultures performing their job.
Okay. And so the dog population is increasing in part because there is more carrion for them to eat. And there is more carrion or carcasses for them to eat because there's this shrinking number of vultures.
That's right.
So let's go one step back in the chain here. Tell us why there's this shrinking number of vultures. I know that it has something to do with livestock, right?
That's right. The main driver of the declines here in India and across South Asia has been the veterinary use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs in cattle, which...
That's like aspirin?
It's, well, particularly diclofenac was the main culprit.
Okay.
20 years ago, but now we know that there are other similar drugs which are also toxic. Some are safe, but some are toxic.
So these painkillers that are commonly used for livestock and obviously do them some good actually kill vultures.
That's right. I mean, it's just an unfortunate feature of their metabolism. They can't basically metabolize diclofenac and it causes gout and kidney failure in the vulture that's consumed a cow that's been treated recently.
But I understand that this painkiller was banned for veterinary use back in 2006. So is it still just being used even though it's banned?
That's right. In 2006, the Indian government and the Pakistan and Nepalese governments took the step of banning it in veterinary use, and that has probably prevented the complete extinction of vultures across the subcontinent. But it's not been enough, sadly. Diclofenac is still legal and used in human medicine, and some vets are irresponsibly still buying it illegally and using it in veterinary practice.
And you said that something like 9,000 people each year in India are dying from rabies?
That's right. I mean, in fact, preventative medicine for and treatment for rabies has improved somewhat. So
yeah,
it's not quite as high
my next
as it
question.
Was.
Yeah.
But still, that's definitely a lot more people than would otherwise be dying from that awful disease.
So besides banning this type of painkiller for livestock, are there other efforts underway in India or the region to help the population recover?
There are. There's a lot of work going on. There's breeding programs underway. But when the environment's not safe enough, we can't release them to many areas yet. So that's frustrating. But having said that, vultures do have other issues going on. They are also susceptible to what we call poison baits. Power infrastructure is often a problem. But this diclofenac problem, you know, is particularly invisible problem, which it took quite a lot of unraveling, actually.
So is the population of vultures in India rebounding at all yet?
In India, it has stabilized at the new low so far. So it's we've prevented them going totally extinct. It is, you know, already a major achievement. Because vultures are slow breeders, they only lay one egg per year and they don't breed until they're 5 years old. So vultures cannot recover very quickly from this catastrophe. And we've lost so many adult birds and so quickly that it will take decades for populations to recover. And probably we will never see quite the same superabundance of vultures as there was 30 years ago.
Vultures, you know, have this bad reputation among humans, but this is clearly a very important function that they perform, limiting the spread of rabies. Do they have other superpowers that we should know about?
Well, vultures are so amazingly adapted to, first of all, finding carrion. They've got fantastic eyesight. They're very social. They rely on signals from each other. They're very intelligent, actually. They pick up on signals and signs from not only from each other, but, you know, from an animal that's maybe sick. You know, they've got huge wingspan. They saw on the thermals and watch each other from afar to locate their prey. And, I mean, they're magnificent birds. But, yes, they do have an image problem. I mean, of course, they're associated with death, and that does, you know, there are superstitions and beliefs which are more negative about vultures. But I think any bird watcher, and actually a lot of rural people, fully appreciate what an important role they play in ecosystem services, cleaning up the environment. And that's a really important role. So, yeah, they're pretty special. And if we're not careful, we can lose them.
We just need to rebrand the phrase, the vultures are circling, to mean something like, the cleanup crew is here.
Yeah, the cleanup crew is a good term for them.
Chris Bowden is with the UK's Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. He spoke to us from Bengaluru. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. We're also now on YouTube. Find us at The World News GBH and subscribe. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Go out there and try to have a fabulous weekend. And we'll see you back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust, Dodie and Billy Crockett, Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser, and Lynn and Bruce Dayton. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.